Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Robert Zubrin, our special guest. We're going to take phone calls with Robert in just a moment as we talk more about going to Mars and other great things in space on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, Robert Zubrin with us. Robert, before we get to the calls, and they're all lining up here for you, what is this interstellar communication using microbes paper that you've done?
Right. Okay, so this paper is available online on Centauri Dreams, so you can people can Google it and find it. But basically, I'm saying this. Okay, people have tried to look for interstellar communication by radio, but if you do the calculation, it's really it's not impossible to do interstellar communication by radio, but it takes a lot of power and big dishes, and it's really unlikely that anybody would just be sending such signals randomly into interstellar space. They might do it if they had a colony in one solar system and another. They could communicate that way. But to be spending gigawatts of power to send out signals just into the void for just to say, hi, we're here.
Doesn't make sense.
No. Now, a different way to communicate, okay, would be by sending particles that are solid objects that have memory inscribed in them. And you could send tiny computer hard drives if you like. But what I'm suggesting is that microbes in their DNA have massive amounts of data storage capability. You can inscribe an entire book into the DNA of a bacterium, and people actually have done that.
Really?
Oh, yes.
And then how do you get it up there into space? You launch it?
Yeah, well, you would launch them into space on rockets. The real issue is how do you get them to go interstellar?
Right.
And the way you would do it is, I mean, bacteria themselves.
And then how do they see it? How do they find it, the recipient?
Well, just slow down. Okay, let me just talk about how you do it, and then I'm going to explain what you're doing, okay? The bacteria themselves are so small that they have such a large surface to weight ratio that the pressure of sunlight can actually shoot them out into interstellar space. Now, if they were naked bacteria like that, they would make the flight, but they would die because ultraviolet light would kill them.
Mm-hmm.
But we could make tiny spacecraft just a few microns across in which there would be like a little ball, maybe 4 microns in diameter, in which we could put the bacteria, and they could be shielded by some carbon to shield them from ultraviolet. And then we'd have a tiny little solar sail, maybe 10 microns in diameter and 1 micron thick, and the sunlight would take that, and it would shoot them right out of the solar system. And they'd go flying and reach other solar systems in time scales of 10,000 years or so, or 100,000 years in some cases. But they would survive the trip, and then they would land and multiply. Now, see, here's the thing. What is the purpose? If you're communicating to people that you don't know, okay, it's propaganda. In other words, if you think of Radio Free Europe or Radio Moscow or the Gideons putting Bibles in hotel rooms, the message is this: be like us. Okay? Be like us. We are good. You should like us. You should be like us. Okay? And it's propaganda. Propaganda and propagation are the same general idea. And so, in other words, would we really want to, you know, broadcast our novels or starship plans into interstellar space by radio, hoping that someone would receive them?
Probably not.
No, but the idea of spreading life, our kind of life, to other solar systems, which we could do by sending microbes. Now, one thing that's obvious, and in fact could actually be happening by naturally, is that microbes can spread from solar system to solar system through natural processes like meteorites hitting planets and splashing off material into space that contains microbes, and it flies through space and eventually gets to another world. That could easily happen, say, between planets within one solar system like Earth and Mars, but even between solar systems it could happen. But what if we were doing this, okay, just imagine this, that we were doing this as engineers, that we were consciously trying to spread our kind of life into space. It wouldn't just be a question of sending some bacteria that would get there and then evolution would begin and who knows what would happen. It would eventually become a biosphere of some type or another. All right, that'd be a good thing to do. But if we were more focused, we might send bacteria that not only could start life there, but would contain in them the genes for future evolutionary adaptations. Now, a couple of years ago, some scientists took some chick embryos and they activated some genes that were in the chick DNA, and lo and behold, the chicks appeared with several dinosaur traits, such
right,
as
right,
teeth.
You're right. It was remarkable.
Yeah. Now, but not that astounding, because birds were once dinosaurs. And so the fact that they might have hidden in their genome, as it were, the files of their previous evolutionary career, which could be activated, okay, like I was once a high school teacher, and even though my license is out of date, I still have that skill. If I want, if I failed as a businessman, if I failed as an engineer, I could go back to being a high school teacher. I still have skills from previous phase in my life. Okay, so the birds still actually have the traits of dinosaurs buried deep in their genome. And if in the future it ever became advantageous for birds to have teeth again, it wouldn't be a question of evolving teeth from scratch, just, you know, a little bit in each generation. They'd go wham, they all of a sudden they'd have teeth, okay? And nice, sharp teeth, okay? Now, so you say, okay, well, that's fine. They were once dinosaurs, so they still got the data on file. Well, how about this? What if someone was trying to influence evolution and they sent out bacteria or other microbes carrying genes that had the plans for future traits? Okay? And these would then land in biospheres and get into the mix, and when the time came where these traits were advantageous, they could emerge quickly.
And how do we know that didn't happen here?
Well, we don't. And that's the interesting thing. In other words, what I'm suggesting is if we're looking for extraterrestrial messages, instead of looking in the sky with radio, let's start looking at the genomes of animals and plants and see if there are some traits that have been planted in them. Okay. Now, I mean, for example, okay, mammals like us or dogs or mice, okay, we're all descended from fish. Okay. We were once fish. And we know we still actually carry fish traits in us, and not only active traits like backbones that we got from them, but in our early stage of embryos, they have gills and so forth. Okay, so, but that's not that surprising. Mice were once fish. All right, fine. So they still have some record of their previous career. But fish were never mice, okay? So if we could look at the genomes of fish and see if planted in them there were any, as it were, forward-looking traits in the genome of fish for the development of amphibians or reptiles or mammals, okay, then that would say, wow, this stuff was loaded in at birth. It's like a parent leaving books around the nursery. Now, they might put some letter blocks that the two-year-old will appreciate and picture books that a four-year-old will appreciate and chapter books that an eight-year-old might appreciate and high literature that a 16-year-old might be able to appreciate. But if these things are found in the nursery, these are evidence of forward-looking thinking, so to speak.
Interesting.
Okay?
Thing.
And
interesting.
Okay. So did anybody put Harry Potter in our nursery?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, we didn't put it there. Did someone else put it there? So, and I'm not saying that this is the case. What I am saying is we should check it out.
Let's take some calls for you. That's a great idea, by the way, Robert. Somerset, New Jersey, we go. Ben's with us. Ben, go ahead. Start us off.
Oh, George, I love you, man.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Zubrin, and I'm really enjoying listening to you. And I'm glad you just went to, I worked for aerospace for quite a long time, and it's cost plus. The cost plus is mainly when the customer doesn't want to get involved with a lot of the work and they want everything done real fast. I was working there when the Vietnam War ended, and our plant went from 4,000 people to 1,400 people. Instead of three people doing the job, they'd have one person doing it. But the cost of the aircraft, the cost of the parts didn't change. And one more thing is the cost of another big cost is everything is military specs. Like you could buy a set of Allen wrenches for $7. And an Allen wrench that has military specs on it is like $17 because of all the tests it has to go through. It's tested before you get the material. It's tested after you cut it. It's tested when you heat treat it. It's tested for this and tested for that. And that's what brings a lot of the cost up.
Well, that is true. But in the example you just gave, that the military wants the Allen wrench to be, now they may overspecify, okay, that is possible, but there's at least some rationality to the military wanting certain tools to meet certain technical specifications. On the other hand, when the government comes in and they want to make sure that the store you bought that Allen wrench from followed affirmative action procedures and so forth and so on, and that you have to know the history of every part, not merely in terms of its technical qualities, but in terms of labor and environmental and other regulations affecting the companies that made it, and did they comply with, you know, this spec and that spec and this regulation and that regulation, and it becomes a nightmare that way. So those do increase the costs, but a lot. And in some cases, it's necessary because, for instance, on the technical side, on a rocket, if one little part fails, the whole thing can fail. So you might want to know that some wiring was not left in an unheated warehouse in Minnesota in the wintertime where it's the cold might have affected its strength. But and this does increase cost, but there's also a lot of other stuff in there that increases cost that does not have functional relevance. But then in addition, the cost plus system, where the company gets to charge the government whatever it costs them plus a certain percent fee on top of that, actually gives them an incentive to increase costs and overheads. If you're working on a fixed price basis, you're looking to cut costs everywhere you can. If you're working the other way, then, well, it's fine. I've got some extra people hanging around here who aren't doing anything. It doesn't matter. It's fine. He developed that heavy lift vehicle for 1/30th the cost that the Augustine Commission predicted. And that's because he's spending the money like it's his own, because a lot of it is.
A lot of it is. Pretty gutsy guy. Matthew in Toronto, Canada, international line. Matthew, go ahead.
Hi. I have a plan. So right now, when we talk about navigating space, now, I'm a musician, audio engineer in school, so bear with me. We plan where we're going, and we do math, and we set headings, and we go in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything right now that's more similar to a compass for navigating in space?
Well, sure. You can use the stars.
Directly?
Yeah. And spacecraft have star trackers on them, and they use those to get their bearings, as well as, of course, the sun.
The sun is important.
But yes, the compasses won't work in space, because they depend upon the Earth's magnetic field, but star trackers certainly do.
Robert, as you look at all the things we've been doing in space over the last 40 years, 50 years, has our technology gotten to the point right? And this is what is so amazing. We got to the moon with 50-year technology. Today, it would seem it would be so easy, we could probably do it in a week, put it together. But why would it take so long?
Well, as I say, you got to have the drive. I mean, you know, and that's what they had. I mean, you know, the government was bureaucratic in the 60s, although not as much as it is now. But there's no question that NASA of the 1960s was mission-driven, and they weren't looking for excuses not to do things. They weren't looking to hype up the risks as an excuse not to go. Okay, they were willing to accept the risk. Okay, you know, there was a part of it was driven by the desire to open space, and part of it was driven by geostrategic imperatives, which nevertheless were valid. Let's astound the world with what free people can do. Okay, and win the Cold War for the free world. And this was risking, worth risking not just treasure, but life to do. And they were willing to do it. And the, so, you know, the people that have signed up with Musk works them really hard.
Are they some former NASA employees that joined
there,
him?
There certainly are some former NASA employees. And because, look, a lot of people joined NASA because they wanted to open the space frontier.
Sure.
Some of them actually got to do important things that way, in particular those that went to JPL and got to do some of these Mars probes and things like that. But a lot of them got stuck elsewhere in bureaucratic posts, and they're looking for to do what they signed up for, which was to open the space frontier. And they see Musk doing this, and they say, let me in. But those are not the most typical SpaceX employees. If I would say the most typical SpaceX employee is somebody who's been out of school for 3 years, you know, and maybe they went straight to SpaceX from college, or maybe they spent a year or two at NASA or Lockheed Martin or Boeing and then managed to get themselves into SpaceX. It's a young team. If you look at that video that SpaceX posted of their people themselves watching the launch, you see, I mean,
they're young tech heads, aren't they?
Well, yeah, but they're passionate. But the typical, my guess is the average age of a SpaceX employee is probably around 28.
Wow, that's it?
Yeah. By the way, that was also the case with NASA in the 60s.
I was just going to ask you that. Okay, Robert, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls with you as we talk about how to live on Mars, some of your other work, of course, including the case for Mars, which is pretty dramatic all by itself. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, James Schwartz joins us as we talk about the other side, so make sure you're part of the program as it lasts all night long. Robert Zubrin with us, his website, MarsSociety.org. What would you say, Robert, is the priority, going back to the moon or heading for Mars with a human?
Well, I think the goal needs to be to send humans to Mars. Okay, now, I do think that if we develop the right kind of Mars transportation system, we'll also be able to do the moon, and we might want to exercise it on moon missions first. And we'll want to be going to the moon at the same time we go to Mars. Where I take my departure from the moon crowd is those who say we have to go to the moon for a generation before we go to Mars. We don't. I think, you know, taking advantage of Falcon Heavy, if we now pick up this opportunity, we can be on the moon in 4 years and on the Mars in 8.
That's pretty dramatic, but you're right. I think that's possible. Back to the calls we go, Coos Bay, Oregon. Let's go to John. Welcome to the program. John, go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, how long would it take to get the first person to actually go to Mars? And, like, how many years and how much money would it take?
All right, you highlighted a little bit on that, Robert, but I'll let you do it again.
Well, you know, it all depends who's doing it. I think we could be on Mars in 8 years. The And I mean, if we go at it the way we did the moon in the 60s, or the way Musk is proceeding now, we could be on Mars in 8 years, absolutely. Now, the trip itself, it takes 6 months to fly to Mars, then you're there for a year and a half, and 6 months to fly home.
That's, and flying home would be so important. When they were trying to go to the moon, weren't they going to do a one-way mission?
Well, at one point, someone suggested we try that because it was so important to beat the Soviets and so forth, but that was rejected. Now, ultimately, we will do one-way missions to Mars because settlement is a one-way mission. But I think that the first people who go to Mars will be explorers who will go there and come back, but they'll set some things up that will allow the people that go next to stay longer and so forth, and at a certain point we'll be ready to go there to stay.
Back to the phones we go. Tom in the Bronx. Hey, Thomas, go ahead.
Yes, how are you?
Good, Tom.
I'd like to say this, that these explorations to other planets, if they find inhabitants of these planets, will these explorations turn out to be a new version of the conquistadors?
Well, they just might be. I guess you would say that the new travelers would be people like that, Robert. Would they not be?
Well, no. I disagree. I mean, I think what the gentleman is suggesting is that, you know, if we go to Mars, we might oppress the inhabitants there. Now, here's the thing. I think Mars is inhabited by microbes. It is not inhabited by people or by higher animals. Okay, it is just that I think there probably are microbes on Mars. I think, and they'd be living underground in the groundwater. And I don't really see how humans on Mars are going to do them any harm, any more than we're harming the microbes that are underground on Earth. If the gentleman was supposing that there were, in fact, civilizations on Mars and we would go there and wreck them, then we would be behaving like the conquistadors and we'd be open to the same condemnation. But if it is just microbes, there are people who go around saying, well, we can't go there because it's their planet. I think that's nonsense. The ethics have to be based on what is best for a set intelligent species, not microbes. You know, people kill microbes all the time. You kill millions every time you use mouthwash in the morning. You know, you kill them if you use antibiotics to cure yourself of a disease. No one says it's morally wrong to use antibiotics. Okay. And so I just think that the idea that it would be morally wrong to interfere with the possession of Mars by microbes are just extrapolating a case of colonialism and so forth on Earth to an example where it doesn't apply.
Next up, let's go to Laura, Hudson Valley, New York. Hello, Laura. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're welcome.
Robert, thank you for the work that you do. I don't want to put a damper on exploration, but I'm someone who's against going to Mars, and the reason why is because I think there's so much to do here. And when you were talking about microbes before, that whole microbe thing, yes, it's really brilliant, but why not take the microbes and neutralize atomic, you know, nuclear waste, or end world hunger, or make sure there's peace on Earth permanently, and neutralize Fukushima and Chernobyl, I mean, you know, and clean up the ozone hole. And I just think that going to Mars is so misguided. And I know a lot of people who are into going to Mars think we have to go to Mars because we've got to get off the Earth because we've messed it up so much. Well, how about if we take this brilliance and all this money and fix it? And I really think we can fix it, and there's so much here to do. And the other thing I just want to mention, before when you said that you think that we'll be in Mars in 8 years, you know, and how that sounded. Well, can you imagine if you said, yes, in 8 years we'll have ended all world hunger and neutralized all atomic waste permanently, and Ebola will be permanently gone from the planet? I mean, isn't that, you know, and everyone on the planet will have clean water everywhere always. So, you know, isn't that better? mean than spending all that time and money and brilliance going to Mars?
We can do both. Well, go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, we can do both. And, look, if Columbus had waited to sail until everything was perfect in Spain, he never would have sailed. But because he did sail, a new branch of Western civilization was established in the New World, which, you know, has given the world many things, including democracy and electricity and aeroplanes and the internet. And all those people in Spain would be a lot poorer today without those things. And we're talking about going to Mars. We're talking about creating a new branch, a new and dynamic and inventive branch of human civilization, which will make its own contributions to social thought and technology and invention and science and literature and all these things. And this is how it will be the greatest benefit. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't try to address problems that exist on Earth, but, you know, they're not exclusive, and a Humans to Mars program would recruit so many more youth to science that we'd have a much greater scientific manpower to address the kinds of problems that you brought up.
What do you think of people who say that we never went to the moon with a man?
Well, I used to think they were ridiculous, but having met the current NASA, I say, well, maybe.
Now, you know we went to the moon, right?
I know. We went to the moon.
But
I know. But
some of their points are compelling.
It required a spirit that we haven't seen in the space program since. And you know what is the most convincing thing that we went to the moon, other than the fact that many of us were around when we did and we saw that we did and we know that we did?
Okay. Well, you had an inspirational president, too, John F. Kennedy at the time.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is the fact that we're now seeing that we have what it takes to go back to the moon and on to Mars, that helps make it convincing that we actually did go to the moon.
Let's go to more calls. Let's go to Brian in Indianapolis. Welcome to the show, Brian. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Good morning. How are you?
Morning, Brian. Thank you.
Hey, I wonder what Gene Trent would say to those people that said we didn't go to the moon.
Yeah.
You know, hey, and if these SpaceX people are as good as what Gene Trent and his crew were, they're going to be dynamic. But I got to thinking, I was looking at your calendar for tomorrow's show about EMPs. And you're talking about having a colony on Mars and this, that, and the other. Would the colony on Mars be susceptible to an EMP attack?
Or a solar flare, of course, not an EMP attack. I don't think anybody would launch a nuke on Mars, but of course, some people think it happened a long time ago. But a solar flare could throw a big X flare at Mars, Robert.
Well, it can, but. I mean, look, we've had plenty of spacecraft in space when there's been solar flares, and very few of them been knocked out. If you take the care to protect the electronics, you can...
They can build a shield, can't they?
Yes. Yeah. Listen, I did want to mention something, because a few minutes ago you mentioned the phrase, How to Live on Mars. I actually have a book called How to Live on Mars. It's not my main book. My main book is called The Case for Mars. But my book, How to Live on Mars... It's a guide to immigrants to Mars from an old hand. It's a kind of a science humor book. Anyway, it is actually on sale right now on Kindle on Amazon for $1.99. They're doing a big promotion.
Jeez, that's it?
Yeah, it's a pretty funny book. It's a mixture of science and science fiction and humor, and a lot of people might like it. So check it out.
Allie is in Des Moines, Washington. Welcome to the show. Hi, Allie.
Well, hello there, and thank you for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I've been a longtime Coast to Coast listener, going back to the days when I belonged to the local chapter of the Art Bell
Catholic. I love it.
My question, and then I actually, while I was waiting, came up with another one,
mm-hmm.
But my main question that's been nagging at me for a long time is, how do they get through the Van Allen Belt?
All right, and we'll come back for your second question in a second. Go ahead, Robert.
You just go through it quickly. Every Apollo mission went through the Van Allen Belt. and every spacecraft that we go into intertropical space goes. So long as you don't just hang out in the Van Allen belt, you're okay.
Yeah. Now, if you hang out, how long do you have to hang out before it's a problem for you?
Oh, I would say a few days, a week. Then you're going to start taking a radiation dose.
Then you get it.
If you're just traveling out to Mars, you'll be through the Van Allen belt in less than an hour.
That's not bad. Okay, Ellie, go ahead with your second question.
Well, another interesting one is I did hear a fellow say that he had actually lived on Mars for 21 years.
Some have said that. Some have said that on this show.
Yeah, well, his name was Randy Kramer.
Okay.
But my other question is another one that I've also had nagging at me is when I heard and saw documents and pictures about the crater chains on Mars. Can you speak about those?
Explain what they are.
They're mounds that look like there might have been a war in space, and they went boom, 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 and a straight row of crater chains.
Well, there have been some thoughts about that. Robert, do you ever take a look at that?
Well, Mars has been bombarded with meteorites, and there's a lot of craters on Mars. And Mars has been hit with cosmic artillery, but not from a war. It's just the meteorites hit it, just like the moon.
And we've been hit a lot, too. You know,
yeah,
I guess
well,
if you took the oceans out.
Sure. Well, there's craters here on Earth. There's a big crater in Arizona.
Oh, my God, yeah.
There's a giant crater in northern Canada where the Mars Society has a station where it's an imitation Mars station on the rim of this crater, which is 20 kilometers in diameter, and has created a lot of geology that is very similar to Mars. So we can explore that area as if we're on Mars and learn how to explore Mars. So there's some craters on the Earth. A lot of craters you can easily see on the moon, and there's craters on Mars, but they're formed naturally from meteors.
Tim is truck driving in the state of Washington. Hey, Timothy, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is, if we have 50-year-old technology that'll lift 120 tons, why do we have to keep reinventing the rocket for each new mission?
Interesting
question.
Why
are we not using what's available and updating the technology?
Well, it's funny you should ask. it's a very good question.
A great question.
No, it was a huge crime when we ended production of the Saturn V. And the Nixon administration, to them, the whole Apollo program was not invented here. And they shut it down, even as the astronauts are coming back from the moon and Nixon was welcoming them back. He was shutting down the whole program. And they even gave the blueprints to the Saturn V to the Boy Scout paper drive in Huntsville, Alabama. And so that was just a crime. And it was stupid. And I would say we'd been much better off if we'd kept the Saturn V going for several more decades. Now, what Musk has come up with now is, in fact, something better.
Finally.
But there hasn't been anything better until now. That is, we would have been much better off with the Saturn V and the Space Shuttle and a variety of other rockets that have come and gone since. But what we have now, what Musk is introducing into the game now, is reusable rockets. And let me just add one thing. If you have a rocket with a reusable first stage that returns to its base, and then you have the other part, instead of going into space, fly across the Earth and land somewhere far away, like fly New York to Sydney. You can do New York to Sydney in less than an hour.
Isn't that amazing?
And I think that that kind of market is going to materialize because this is the technology that can do it. It would make no sense using expendable rockets to do long-distance transportation on Earth. It would be like flying airliners once and throwing them away. But with reusable rockets, that could become possible. And then instead of launching 100 rockets a year, we'd be launching hundreds a day.
Many. Robert, thank you for being on the program. Robert Zubrin, his website, MarsSociety.org. Up next, we're going to be talking about one voice, sacred wisdom, the spirit guides.